to the part two of study number seven here on 1 Timothy. We are on the, we'll just review number two. It says, we must keep in mind that there are no blank when Paul gives these guidelines in 1 Timothy. What is in that blank? You should have that one in there, I think.
Denominations.
Yeah, denominations. There are no such thing as denominations at this time that he writes this, because he writes this in about 63 AD, and it's the beginning of the early church, early Christian church. It's not even a welcomed church at this time, or a belief, because there's all kinds of gods that are being worshipped in a lot of these different places. And so when Paul goes to preach about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and his teachings, he's always met with what?
Resistance.
Yeah. And he doesn't have an easy time. And so the early church, the first 200 years, it has been persecuted. I mean, no matter where it got started, who became a Christian, it was not an easy life. So it wasn't until about 200 years later that it becomes more of an accepted religion in society. And it probably comes through a guy by the name of, is it Constantine? So I think Constantine, was it him that wanted a sign from God about a battle? And he saw a cross in the sky? And that was through him that he said, because they won the battle. And that was a sign, they believed, for the cross that was associated with Jesus Christ and with Christianity. And then it became a, like, the national religion that was to be accepted wherever there was Christians. And that was a turning point of the early church. And so so then you have, you know, after Constantine, there's Alexander the Great, and he's got some, I think his mom was Helena. And so Helena made the big Christian church in, you've been there, Turkey.
Turkey.
Istanbul. It's Sophia.
Awesome, yeah.
That was a Christian church.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And it was because of Helena. And then after the Islam had conquered Turkey, then they redid the cathedral. Then made it into the Sophia, and they added minaret towers that weren't there before.
And they covered the beautiful mosaics.
Yeah, yeah. Which is very typical when Islam goes to different countries and conquers them. They will try to do away with anything of what the people believed in prior to them coming. Especially Christianity. They'll destroy churches, or they will build on top of the churches, or recreate the churches into a mosque or some kind of a symbol of saying that their God is more powerful than the God of the country that they just conquered. And so that's why you find in Jerusalem that there once was a cathedral up there that they made into a mosque. And so don't get, you know, the golden dome that you see, that's not a mosque. That is just a symbol that Islam conquered this country. And of course, the golden dome is where Muhammad left this earth on his horse and went up into heaven. And so there's a big rock inside the dome of the rock in Jerusalem, and that's kind of associated with Islam. And of course they're very, very particular. You know, no one can go inside there unless you're a Muslim. You can't go in there unless there's special days or something. I don't know. But I know we couldn't go inside when we saw the Dome of the Rock. So
you could go in the Hagia Sophia, but you were just kind of on the perimeter. You just can't.
Yeah.
But you couldn't.
Couldn't actually walk around inside?
No. Yeah. There were people in there praying on their rugs.
Okay,
stuff,
sure. Yeah.
We stayed behind them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting.
So we could at least see.
Yeah. So there was, I mean, there was a Roman Catholic church up on the Temple Mount. So, I mean, as soon as you go into the Temple Mount to the right, as you go into the right, you got to pass these Philistines, which are probably the PLO, Palestinians.
Philistines.
They got the big bushy beards. And then they converted the church that was there, built by the Romans, and converted that into a mosque. And there's a name for that mosque that's there. But you and I can't go in there unless we are Muslims. So at any rate, just to keep in mind that as Paul is writing this to his spiritual son, Timothy, who's a young pastor, there is no such thing as denominations. But Paul is just saying, here is something that I think is important for you as a young pastor involved in the Christian faith that you need to know that will help the church, will help you and help the church in the days ahead. So that takes us to number three. So depending on your religious background, a church can have two groups of leadership. And so one deals with the spiritual needs going on in the church, and the other one deals with the physical needs of the church. And that's typically how it's set up today. You know, the spiritual side, there can be different names in a church for the spiritual side. And so one of the things, like, we find that Paul says to Timothy is overseers. You have overseers. They deal with the spiritual side. And overseers can also be known as what?
Elders.
As elders or as bishops. You know, those kinds of things. Can be pastor. It all depends upon how and where you live type of a thing of what you will find there. Deacons. A deacon can be like an elder as well. They're called deacons. Some places a deacon is more like a trustee. So that would be more the physical side of the church. That the church pays the lighting and it's got running water and heat and air conditioning and paint. And that's kind of, it just depends what church you go to, or the deacons will, some deacons can be like trustees, or sometimes deacons can be like elders, can be more the spiritual side. But that's today in a church, usually there's two groups, and sometimes they've come together, the deacons and the elders and the trustees have a trustee board, an elder board, and then they have a joint board that they both sides come together and they discuss business every month type of a thing. That's been my experience over the years of how it's done. And it's different sometimes in other different denominations how they do that. So we go to spiritual needs are called, and I guess I gave you those names, didn't I?
Yeah.
Spiritual needs are called, go ahead, Bobby.
No, I'm sorry, I was like, Dawn, did I miss it? I was a pain. Yes, you did give us.
You
have to remember and write it down.
Yeah. Okay. So you can write down the blanks that are there. Spiritual needs are called overseers, elders, pastor, bishop. Some places it can be deacon. So that's kind of the spiritual side of things. And the spiritual side of the church is to make sure that the church stays on track with what the Bible says. That's really what the responsibility is. Making sure that, you know, because, you know, pastors come and pastors go. And so what may one pastor that leaves could be different than the next pastor that comes. But the elders or those in the spiritual authority of the church are to make sure that what the congregation is hearing, it is coming from God's word, from the Bible. And that's what they're, one of part of their duties is. You get to like trustees, You know, I think we talked about this last week. You know, sometimes they have a lot to do with keeping track of the funds that come into the church. They're the ones who will count the offering or make sure, you know, they're trustworthy people is who you have. You don't want somebody who's a little shady or a little bit likes five-finger discount things at Walmart, where they like to steal things. You want someone that's very trustworthy. And I think one of the hardest positions in a church is treasurer, because you have to be zip the lips. You cannot let anybody know who gives what or what have you, anything like that. And that's a hard position to have. So you got to really make sure whoever the treasurer is, whoever handles the finances, that they just are very, very conscientious of watching what they say and how they say it. But they should be the only ones that know what goes on financially in the church as far as who gives what as a treasurer. As a pastor, I don't want to know who gives what. And I don't know who gives what here at Harbor of Joy. And so sometimes that's not always the case. Sometimes at a board meeting, finances are talked about, and sometimes things can slip from the mouth of a treasurer that shouldn't. So then therefore the board has to be very careful in what they hear too. And they can't share anything with their spouse at home if they're married. It's just a way of protecting things, and it's just
some churches publish who gives what.
Well, yeah, and see, that's not good.
I belonged to a church like that once.
Yeah, that's not good.
That's what I thought. That's not a good thing.
Because it just causes, I think, sometimes competition, or it sows bad seed, I think. You get bad fruit from that. And, of course, some people then can take, well, you know, they can pat themselves on the back or go like, look what I've done. I can, you know, everybody knows what I've given here. And you don't want that. It should be between you and God, what is given. And that's where it's left.
Giving and put it in cash.
Yeah.
Yep. That's smart.
You could do that too, however you want to do it. But the church treasurer is one that will take care of all that. And that person needs to be trusted and very tight-lipped. And so not everybody wants to be a treasurer either. Okay, so physical needs, you know, can be deacons or it can be trustees, and we're gonna come into another one here. What's that?
A board.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about the janitor?
The janitor will fall under the trustees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, the next one under it says, well, what about women? You know, because Paul is talking to Timothy, giving him that the overseer and the deacon, he makes pretty plain that they are to be whom?
Men.
He specifically spells it out. Men. Of course, you got to go back to 63 AD. Women at that time in history, did they have a real voice in anything? They didn't. Even in Judaism, you know, Judaism, they had a place in the temple for women to worship, but it was in the back. But women were not allowed really to do anything, you know. Even kind of sometimes, they weren't involved in any kind of church decisions at all. But that's where Christianity changes things. And that's would be something that society at that time wouldn't be so welcoming with that either. That let women do that, or women can't do that type of thing. But Christianity includes women in being a part of ministry. So what about women? What does verse 11 say? We're in chapter 3. Does someone want to read verse 11?
Women likewise must be serious, not slanderers, but temperate, faithful in all things.
Okay. In the beginning there, Norma, your Bible says likewise?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Women likewise.
Okay, yeah, women likewise. Otherwise, some other translations will say what? Women?
Mine says in the same way.
In the same
way.
Yep, in the same way. Yep. Wives or? Is it just wives?
Yeah, mine is.
In the same way, their wives are to be women worthy of respect.
Okay.
Nor malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything.
Okay. So in the first blank, it says, in the same way, because that's the Bible I've got to use, but you can use likewise. In the same way, likewise, are these wives of the deacons, or are they women in general in the church, or could they be deaconesses? You know what a deaconess is?
I think they're women in general, aren't they?
It's a woman, yeah. There's a word that's missing here in the translation. The Greek word for woman that's used here is called, spelled G-Y-N-E. So is that like a gynecologist? What do they call that?
That's
right. Yeah. But the word that's used in the Greek, G-Y-N-E, can be translated in the New Testament as both woman or wife. A pronoun there, T-H-E-I-R, is absent in the Greek text. The pronoun there is absent in the Greek text. So what I'm getting at there is, it says, when it comes about women, it's believed that it's referring to deaconesses in the context of what is being spelt out here. A woman deaconess is someone who is very much involved, a lot of times behind the scenes, in just helping people with a lot of different things. The deaconess. Sometimes some churches have deaconess boards or the deaconess group. Not every church has those.
So what do you want us to put there? Are there yes or no? Or?
Well, I at first I put both. But then as I further read and researched it out, it kind of says it's referring to deaconesses, women. Deaconesses are women. And so it's spelt out that Phoebe, you got Romans 16:1, a woman by the name of Phoebe, P-H-O-E-B-E. And then in Romans 16:3, you have one who, her name rhymes with Aquila.
Priscilla.
And then in Acts, you've got Lydia. We talked about Lydia before, a seller of purple. And so they just kind of point out that, you know, there are women involved in ministry, and they could definitely have been qualified enough to even be deaconesses for the way that they helped out. And Lydia. Yeah, I didn't say Lydia. So there's kind of just three names that we find in the New Testament of women that are active in helping out in ministry. So when Paul talks about, you know, he says that women are not to be malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. You know, why would Paul say that? Why would he mention this here?
He knows they need the women in there somewhere.
Well, he knows they're involved, but he puts, you know, he raises the bar that he says that, you know, again, it goes back to godliness. A woman in the Christian church should be someone that is not a gossip, but someone that is really there to be helpful. And is an example to younger women as well, and to the church as a whole, that this is how you are to be as a woman. Godliness is a part of that, which is very important. Same with men. Men are to be godly men, and there's a higher standard, a higher requirement for men as to be spiritual leaders and spiritual
just qualified to be spiritual leaders as well. Now, you're not going to find a perfect guy. You're not going to find a perfect woman. But the Apostle Paul does give some pretty specific guidelines as far as what should be used when it comes to looking for people to be leaders in the church. He does say that.
He said that.
Yep.
But you say he liked coming.
Well, he's looking out, you know, what is best. He's looking at what is best for the church. Because there's women involved in the church. You know? He never got married.
No, I'm not.
Paul was never married. But he just said that, you know, when you look at his own life, he sees that if a guy is married, he is not going to be able to do as much in the work as someone who's not married. And Paul could do, Paul did a lot. He traveled a lot. He was gone a lot. Could you see him as a married man? And it's, I just don't think it would work with all that he did. So, but he just says, you know, your interests are divided when you're married. And so you probably cannot do as much, but it's okay if you're married as well. You know, he wasn't against marriage. It's better to marry than to just burn, lustfully or whatever. You know? So it's okay to marry, but he just said you can do more if you are not. And that's, I think that goes along, that's a special calling to be a celibate. Now in the Catholic Church, in order to be a priest, you have to be celibate. But does that mean that everybody is celibate? I mean, a celibate in wait, I mean, they're not married, but does that mean that they all hold to that standard? Or do there some that fall off the wagon? Or there's some that have somebody on the side? You know, and I think a lot of the things that we hear today going on in the Catholic Church that they've paid millions of dollars for, you know, the abuse of boys in the Catholic Church, as well as illicit affairs that take place. I just don't think it's a good thing that they have men that have to be celibate. Why can't they have married clergy in the Catholic Church? It would solve a lot of things. But they hold up that being celibate is a calling from God, and therefore it's a high calling, and it's not for everybody, but they're the only ones that can be the priests, which I don't understand because I didn't grow up Catholic. But I go like, how does a priest give premarital counseling when they've never been married? You know, I mean, I don't understand that. And yet, you go to premarital counseling, and you're getting it from a guy who's never been married. And so I just don't know how that works. But that goes on today.
Do they draw some of this from the idea of Paul and Peter?
Well, they go from Peter. It goes back to Peter's confession that upon this rock the church will stand, type of a thing. But, you know, again, Peter means rock. But I think it's a misinterpretation of the Catholic Church of how they think that that's the beginning of the Pope. So you have to stay in line of the Pope being from Peter, an extension of Peter's lineage or something like that. But there's been a lot of things that have happened throughout church history that just blows that all apart. And yet, that's a very crucial thing for the Catholic Church. And it's a big church. It's got a lot of power. So the higher standard, there's a higher standard for those that are in church leadership. And so why is there a higher standard for church leadership? Why do you suppose?
Be an example.
be an example? Why do you need an example of a higher standard? What does that do for the church as a whole? The functioning of the church to have a higher standard.
Trust.
Yeah, trust. Unity. Try to keep unity. Peace. You know, place to go where there's peace in the church. So it's with a, so the higher standard is there to make that the church is different from really any other organization on this earth. It's a unique organization. And we'll get into that more next week. The last one here is, it says, what is the benefit that goes along with being a deacon that serves well? Verse 13. What's the benefit?
Good standing.
Good standing. Respect goes along with that.
Become boldness in the faith.
What's that?
Boldness in the faith.
Yeah. I mean, so there's some confidence that goes along with that. There's some assurance that goes along with being someone who serves well in church leadership, that not everybody understands what that is until you are in that role, until you have that office. Here, I mean, I've got, in the blank there, I got an excellent standing. But that's always, an excellent standing is, involves that it's someone who serves well. Can you have someone who doesn't serve well? You have the title or the name of deacon. Doesn't mean you do anything else. But you got the deacon name. But it doesn't mean you're really serving other people in the church. But you're there. But you have to keep in mind that you're there because why? If you are on church leadership, there's a reason why you are there. Who is it that puts you there?
Church members.
You've been voted on because you are seen through the eyes of other people or who know you that this is where you serve. And they see you've got something there that is very helpful for the congregation to be there. So it's not to let, you don't let that go to your head. You just, it's a bigger responsibility. It should really be more humbling than anything else. So did Dean Ramsey want to be president of Harbor of Joy?
Doubt it.
No, he didn't want to be. He'd be the first to say, no, sir, no way. But he was voted as the president. And I just have encouraged Dean of saying, Dean, you're just going to get stretched in more ways than you've ever been stretched before. But the people have trust in you to be that person. And for how long can a person be the president of the congregation here at Harbor of Joy? How much? Yeah, it's a one term. One term is 3 years. You can serve two terms. But you have to go off after six. It's just a good thing to not have to serve and let somebody else come in there too. New blood is good to have. I don't know if you've ever heard of this pastor in Aberdeen, South Dakota. His name is Harold Salem.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
6 o'clock.
You know, we had him come to a pastor wives retreat up in Bismarck one time. Hilarious guy I've ever met. He's got stories, all kinds of stories. And he goes, now he's speaking to other pastors and their wives. He goes, so what do you do if you've got someone who's giving you trouble in the church? And he could be an elder or he could be a trustee. He goes, what do you do when you got trouble like somebody like that on the board? He goes, I got an idea. At least it's been helpful for me. You outlive them. But he just goes, you just got to outlive your boards. They go, who stays that long in one church? Pastors come and pastors go.
Was he in that church a long, long time?
Oh, yeah. 40-some years.
Okay.
I think he was. Yeah. Which I go, like, that's unheard of. There's a Assembly of God pastor in Dickinson who's been there, well, he's been probably 45 years. You know? Hessler. If he's still there, he's gone over 50 years. You know? But it's just, it's very unusual that somebody stays that long in the same church. But it can be done. You know? I just have always felt this, that it's better to leave as a pastor when when people still like you.
Yeah.
Than to feel you have to go because everything is upside down and everybody's blaming you for something.
He's still on the air, isn't he?
Yeah, they're taped. They're taped messages.
Who else is still on? Yeah. Dying how many years ago was that? Dr. Kennedy.
Oh, yeah. Yep. James Kennedy.
And they still have his shows on TV.
Yeah. It was the First Presbyterian Church in Florida. Yeah.
It was great, but it's kind of weird to...
No. His count is still alive.
No.
It's what?
He's not still alive.
No, he's not alive.
He died probably 15 years ago.
Yeah, he's been gone quite a while. I know Sharon's dad watched Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked him.
Very faithfully, too. So.
We talk about pastors staying. Emmanuel in Spirit Lake, the pastor there, and this has been a number of years ago, he came from seminary, and he retired at the same church.
Wow.
And I imagine that was 40, 45 years, too. Ansorgi.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Ansorgi.
Ansorgi?
And he came right from seminary over there and stayed until he retired.
Yeah, the difficult thing with anyone staying a long, long time at one church, it's the next person that follows you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the wise thing for a church to do is to have an intern. Someone that comes in just knowing that they're going to be there for a short time until you get the next pastor in. So someone kind of plays the buffer. So that helps the people get ready for the next pastor that comes. Because if you don't have that internship, it can be very difficult. Because no matter when there's a change of pastors, you got people who will leave, and you'll have some new ones that will come, and you still have some that'll still be scratching their heads wondering, is this really the right guy? You know. But there's a lot of different emotions that go on when there's a change in pastors. But some can stay a long time, and some, you know, I just always prayed. I said, Lord, you know, give me the humility to know when it's time to go. I mean, we've had good churches.
Wherever. What's the longest you stayed in a pastor?
18 and a half years was in Dickinson, North Dakota, before we came down here. And I was just kind of...
Wow.
Went out for lunch one afternoon with Sharon, and we kind of go like, so how much longer are we going to stay here? And I'm going, I think the people have heard my voice long enough, but I don't know where to go. I don't know what the next step is. There's no other place I'd want to go.
Yeah, you felt like you wanted to leave, but you didn't.
Yeah, we just
needed God to tell you where to go.
Yeah, we just didn't know what to wear. And then so our daughter called about this chaplaincy that opened up down here. And then, of course, she said something that was a real zinger. Dad, you've always chosen the church over us girls.
Ooh.
And I'm going, I did not. But that's, I said, well, that's her point of view, but I go, I don't agree with that. But anyway, we came. And now we're here, we go.
And it's
interesting.
As it should be.
Yeah, it is interesting.
We're right here.
Yes. Yes.
Hasn't the pastor of Emmanuel been there a long time? Or is it?
See, I don't know a lot of these pastors here. I don't know. I think the one at the Presbyterian Church, Clint, I don't know his last name, He's been here quite a while. Presbyterian, but, you know, typically, you know, I don't think it's good for a pastor to be like 3-4 years and then gone. Because he's just getting to know the people, and the people are just getting to know him. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes they leave too early, and sometimes you're in denominations that you have to move. When they tell you to move and you're going to this place, you got to do it. And I go like, I don't like that. I go like, but you know, there again, you just have to trust the people in charge or over you. But I just said, well, God moves people when he wants them to move. Hopefully the people will listen. The pastors will listen to his voice. So anyway, that's the last question of this study, number 5. What did you put in the blank for B, 5B? A great blank.
A great boldness.
Okay, could be boldness.
Confidence.
Confidence, could be assurance. In his personal blank, in Christ Jesus.
Faith.
Faith, yeah. Faith. So there's something good that happens in the life of whoever serves the people in the church. And they do it well. That's the main thing. Do it well. There are some people who like to have the authority, but they don't like to serve. And to me, that's what you always look for in anybody. It's, do they have a servant's heart? That's, I think it's important in any pastor. Do they love people? Do they like being with people? And do they like serving?
Thinking about what we're talking about, and with Paul sharing all this with Timothy, you know, a lot of it would be, I mean, the thing is kind of common sense. I mean, you know, but you think Paul has however many years he's been ministering, 30 years or whatever, he has learned that these specific things or whatever are important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Timothy, you need to start out knowing this, yeah. Not take 30 years to learn. You know, that's how I look at it.
Yeah.
You know, these are things you need to really be aware of.
Yeah.
I mean, he thought they were important enough, obviously.
Yeah.
And we know they are, but, you know, you think, well, wouldn't you think they know? But, you know,
yeah.
Not always.
Right, mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah. Well, it was a new concept at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nothing like it. There's nothing like it. As we'll find out next week, as we move on, I mean, there's only like 3 verses left, I think, in chapter 3.
Yeah,
so I mean, we'll find out some unique things in just those 3 verses next week that makes what's going on here pretty unique. The church is a unique place.
Yeah, and they were used to the Pharisees kind of lording over them and how they were, so it's kind of like... No, that's not how you're supposed
right,
to be.
Right.
So it's setting up a new standard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Pharisees loved they loved the authority and what all the religious duties they had. But they really did not care for the people.
Well, they cared more about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Than their position.
Yeah.
The pride, the prestige.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all their rules that they had to follow.
Yeah, they thought that by following Moses' laws, they were in good standing with God. The more laws they could keep, the better God loved them.
Right. Just think if we had this study then, you and Dave, Denny would be here, but we couldn't come.
Oh, yeah.
We had no say.
Yeah. Stay home and wash clothes.
I still see the women had more. They just didn't write it down. The women ran the household.
Oh, yeah.
The home.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the thing is, it's... It was very important. Home life was very important.
Right.
I mean, that was the bedrock of society.
Right.
If you didn't have the homes, the kids... moms, the dads, and you didn't have Jesus. But the Jews, that's made the Jews different from everybody else. I mean, they worship Yahweh, Jehovah, you know, the living God. And there are certain things that this God had spelled out to these people that if you are my people, then this is what I have for you if you obey me. So it comes down to a relationship with their God to obey the things that he has for them, because everything that God did, was it good? It was always good. Did the people always obey? No. Kind of a lot like us today, isn't it? If we could get that down right to always be obedient, hey, it'd be a lot different than what we see this world in the condition that it's in. Well, let's pray, and we did use up most of the hour. Well, I better shut this up.